Hi there. This is Jennifer Passarello from CircaNineteenXX.com. Welcome to Circa Sunday Night, the podcast. You know, I always think of Circa 19XX land as time travel for the imagination, where we explore all kinds of glamorous and beautiful old things from the early part of the 20th century. So go put on your fringe and your long rope of pearls, and let's Charleston our way to Dreamsville. It's the cure for insomnia. It's Circa Sunday Night. Good evening. Oh, alas, another weekend has gone by, hasn't it? Well, we still have tonight, right? So let's try to hang on to our Sunday as long as we can. Well, greetings to you from my patio in Kansas City, Missouri, where the moon is shining bright on the pond in the distance. And wow, it is a crystal clear sky in my town tonight. All the stars are out. You know, I've been doing these shows from my patio the last few episodes, and I just really like being out here. You know, I can't be out here in the winter, so I've got to enjoy myself while I can, while it's nice and warm. But I love it when the stars are out. So you look up at that big sky, and you see all of those stars, and all of our troubles just seem so small, don't they? Kind of puts things in perspective. And you know what else I think helps put things in perspective? Peering into the lives of people of the past. And that's exactly what we're going to do tonight. How do you like that for a segue? The subject of our show tonight is Jean Harlow. Yes, Jean Harlow. Now, would you believe that prior to my research for this episode, I had never seen a single Harlow film? And now, I feel like I know her. I feel like she's a neighbor across the yard, across the fence. I mean, this would have to be a really glamorous and expensive fence because she was a huge star back in the day, don't you know? I said this when I did the episode on Coco Chanel. And it's definitely true tonight as we sort of explore the life and the times of Jean Harlow. When you spend hours researching someone, and you're learning about their life and their work, their ups and their downs, you really do start to become attached to them. It's as if you know them. Or, I don't know, maybe that's just an indication of how weird I am. But anyway, I feel like I'm pretty attached to Jean Harlow at the moment. Over the last 2 weeks, I've read 2 books about her. I've read countless articles, both online, you know, current day articles, as well as archived newspaper articles from the 1930s, which was her era. And then, of course, I watched several of her films. Over the course of that time, I have just become so fond of her. And of course, her death draws on your sympathy. You know, to this day, I have not been able to watch her last film, Saratoga. I can't do it. It's just too sad for me. I think I need to put a little bit more distance between me and all this research that I've done to get, you know, a little bit in a better place to watch that movie. I do want to see that film. Okay, so enough with all that. Let's talk about Jean Harlow's life, and then we'll get to some of the other topics that I'm planning to cover in tonight's show. So, if we think about the 1930s, Jean Harlow was probably the biggest star that the world had ever known, really. She was the original blonde bombshell. You know, we think about Marilyn Monroe, but Jean Harlow was really the first. She had this very fresh, sultry look that, of course, drove men crazy, and it also kind of drove women to peroxide, right? She had that white, blonde hair, that platinum blonde that really became the thing. So a lot of women wanted to, they wanted to have their hair like her. So they went and they bleached and peroxided and did all kinds of stuff they probably shouldn't have been doing to their hair. But that was the style at that time. She had said, "I'm the worst actress that was ever in pictures." Those were her words to all of her fans. It really didn't matter because she had like this it factor, you know, that indefinable it quality that just seemed to draw people to her like a magnet. And honestly, you know, her assessment of her own acting ability might have been a little bit too extreme. She wasn't the worst actress who ever lived. She wasn't the best. You know, she wasn't the greatest actress I've ever seen. She never won an Academy Award, never would win an Academy Award, probably. But I'll tell you what I thought was really fascinating about her is that she was a really astute observer. She made a study of her craft, and she would study her co-stars. You know, when other co-stars would make a beeline to their dressing rooms, she would kind of hang out on the set and watch what the other stars were doing. And you can see that improvement over time. You know, some of her later films, like Wife versus Secretary, which is one of my favorites, she was quite good, I thought. What she lacked in acting ability, she really made up for with charm and vivaciousness and, of course, sex appeal. Yeah, I mean, you know, she was pretty. That's true, she was pretty. But more than that, she was really overtly and brazenly sexual. That's probably what she's known for today. Well, and also in her own time. So it was really well known, for example, that she never wore underwear. No, that was just not her thing. Not only did she talk about the fact that she didn't wear underwear, it was really obvious sometimes. She'd walk on the set and she'd be wearing a sheer gown or, you know, something that you could see through. And it was clear to everybody that she was wearing nothing underneath. Now, David Sten is an author of the book Bombshell, The Life and Death of Jean Harlow. And that was one of the books that I read for this episode. And he describes this one incident that is just one of many incidents that really are on this theme of her comfort level with nudity and, you know, just her general feeling about her own body. On the set of the film, The Redheaded Woman, she did this, and this is from Sten's book. "Most astounding to MGM crews was Harlow's attitude toward her body. Told by Jack Conway, the director of that movie, to remove her jacket in a scene, she obeyed. But she had nothing on underneath. So visitors on the set scarcely believed their eyes. But, you know, when there was all this resulting commotion, Harlow was pretty puzzled. She said, "I'm sorry, but nobody gave the order to cut." And this was not an isolated incident at all. To some people, and actually to me too, when I was first reading about this, it seems kind of like it's just pure exhibitionism. But in reality, I think it was evidence of just this total and complete comfort with her body, coupled with this natural detachment. Several of her co-stars mentioned that she just didn't seem to care. In The Redheaded Woman, the writer of that particular film, Anita Loos, she said this. She said, "Jean Harlow had no vanity whatsoever. I mean, she was so down to earth that she just didn't think very much about herself. And so not wearing underwear, appearing nude in public, it was just not anything she really thought that much about." Now, I've been interested in Jean Harlow for years, and I think I mentioned this a moment ago, but I'll say it again. I first became curious about her when I discovered that her hometown was my hometown, Kansas City. And then, you know, of course, when I found out that she died at the age of 26, well, you know, that always lends kind of an air of mystery to a person's life. And so, you know, it's hard to get past that. I mean, how could someone have reached such enormous heights in their career at such a young age? I'll tell you, one day I came across this beautiful portrait of her modeling this frilly pink negligee that had been designed for her by the designer Dolly Tree, and Jean Harlow was modeling it, and they took a picture of it, and I saw this caption under the photo. And this was actually in Sten's book. And the caption said, that the picture was taken in May of 1937 and that she would later, that, you know, a month later, be buried in that same negligee. Strangely, when I read that line, it just made my stomach drop. It just kind of amplified my sympathy for her. So, of course, I wanted to learn more about her. Not every one of her films is my cup of tea. I do think I would have liked her. By all accounts, she was just this very nice girl who was really not anything like the other big name actresses of her day. She hadn't aspired to be a star. She would have really preferred to be a successful writer. But circumstances, as well as her very calculating mother — her mother was quite a piece of work, actually — but, you know, circumstances and her mother really sort of tilted her life in the direction of Hollywood. You know, throughout her life, she was really manipulated and underestimated, and she lived perpetually under her mother's thumb, I mean, even at the very end. So as a result of all of that, I think there was an insecurity and a vulnerability there, and that really comes across in her film roles. Just about everyone seemed to love her. The cast, the crew, studio executives, they all seemed to love her. Now, she lived a really dramatic life both on and off screen. Okay, so she was no angel. She was not perfect. She had developed a pretty serious drinking problem. She had already had 3 marriages by the time that she died. And, oh, here's quite a story. One of her husbands killed himself only 2 months after the wedding. And at the time, there was a lot of controversy. Did he really kill himself or was he murdered? And, you know, I think the bottom line is he did kill himself. But, I mean, 2 months after the wedding. But the love of her life was the actor William Powell, and he refused to propose to her. In addition, she longed to have a family, and it just never came to fruition. You know, hers was not a charmed life, but she was a very prominent citizen of circa 19XX land, and she was a kind, friendly girl from Missouri, and one that I would have liked to meet. So, that is sort of our introduction to Jean Harlow. Let me recommend a couple of books if you want to learn more about her life. The first one is the Sten book that I had mentioned. It's called Bombshell, The Life and Death of Jean Harlow. The second one is a book by Mark Vieira, and it's called Forbidden Hollywood, When Sin Ruled the Movies. That deals with the code, the Hays Code, and we'll touch on that a little bit in tonight's show. All right, so there is an awful lot to cover tonight. Let's just do a quick rundown of our agenda. We'll begin by taking a little tour of the movie business in the 1930s. That was Harlow's era, and so we're going to explore it a little bit. Then we will look at this fascinating article. This is so fascinating. It's an article that I found in the Kansas City Star Archives from 1937, and it's called The Beauty Business in Hollywood. We will then do a quick rundown of the movies that make up what I call the Harlow canon. And these are the films that were mentioned most often in the books and articles that I read in preparation for this show. Now, one of the films in the canon we'll spend a little bit of extra time on. It's Libeled Lady, which I think is my all-time favorite Jean Harlow film. So we'll spend a little bit more time on that one. Then here's one of the more interesting aspects of Jean Harlow's life, and there were so many interesting aspects of her life, but this is my favorite. She was a writer. She wrote a novel. I'll talk a little bit about that novel that she wrote, but I also found this very charming little short story that she wrote as well, and I'm going to read that short story to you. Now, don't worry, it's very short. Then we'll talk about the death of Jean Harlow because, well, we just have to. If you're going to talk about Jean Harlow, you have to talk about her death. Her death rocked the film industry, and it devastated her fans. So we will touch on it in tonight's episode as well. And then, of course, we'll wrap up, as we always do, with my favorite thing of the week. And this one is a little wacky, so stay tuned until the end of the show for the big reveal. Okay, so we've got lots to do tonight. To get going, I want you to close your eyes. Picture yourself stepping out of real life and into the black and white Art Deco settings of a movie from the 1930s. It's the golden age of Hollywood, and there's lots to see. So let's go. The 1930s is probably the most important decade in the history of motion pictures. There were technological advances in sound and even color. Even though most of the films that were produced in the 30s were black and white, there were some notable exceptions. I mean, if you think about Gone with the Wind, that was in color. Wizard of Oz was in color. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was an animated film, but it was in color. So there were a lot of advancements in the 1930s. All of Jean Harlow's films were in black and white. However, there is one segment within her breakout film, Hell's Angels, which I believe came out in 1930. There's a small segment within that film that is in color. It's a party scene, and it is the only color footage of Jean Harlow. So kind of interesting. Yeah, the whole rest of the film is in black and white, and then you come across this segment just out of nowhere happens to be in color. So a kind of an interesting little feature of that film. What they were trying to do with all of this is create this dazzling experience for theatergoers, right? And the theatergoers at that time really needed that dazzling experience, because we have to remember that the 1930s is when the Great Depression was in full swing. And so life didn't really look all that good to those theatergoers. So they would go to the movies for a form of escape. Although, you know, the film industry was also impacted by the Depression. That was something that I had recently learned. I thought that that was one of the few industries that did really well during the Depression, but no, they too had to do layoffs and that kind of thing. So they were impacted as well. Now, the filmmakers of this era really did escapism very well for that reason, you know, try to help people escape the Great Depression. And so some of the most famous films, some of the films that are now considered classics, were made in that decade. Let's do a little snapshot of Hollywood in the 1930s. We have to start with the studio system, because the studio system is really synonymous with golden age Hollywood or classic Hollywood. Essentially, what the studio system did is it ensured that the major studios of the day had complete control over the entire film production process. One of the central practices of the studio system was something called block booking, and here's how that worked. A studio would sell packages of films to theaters, and each of these packages or blocks would contain one high-budget potential hit and then a whole lot of lower budget films. Now, this was a really smart setup when you think about it, because it enabled the studios to make a lot of movies that were lower budget movies and still ensure that they were distributed. So, you know, pretty smart setup. Of course, all the theaters wanted the big hit, but in order to get the big hit, the high dollar, big budget hit, they had to also take the smaller, lower budget films too. Now, the biggest studios also had controlling stakes in their own chains of theaters, and that also ensured distribution of their pictures. Now, as I said before, the studios controlled every aspect of film production. So the actors, the producers, the directors, the writers, they were all under contract. They were employees. But the studios also owned things like film processing laboratories. So as I said, the stars were the employees of the studios, and the studios went to tremendous lengths to create these images for their stars. And in fact, they would make sure that there were roles that were written for particular stars to sort of bolster the image that the studio was trying to project. And, you know, of course, the natural personalities and talents of the stars as well. But what's kind of interesting is the images that were portrayed of these stars often bore little resemblance to their real lives. And then, you know, if you look at the contracts that these stars were operating under, there were morality clauses in those contracts. So if the stars made it really big, those studios controlled virtually every aspect of their lives. even those things in their personal lives. It was quite a system. Another thing that we have to talk about if we're examining Hollywood in the 1930s is the Hays Code. The Hays Code, or what it was officially known as, was the Motion Picture Production Code, was really the precursor to our present-day rating system. So the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America, has a rating system, and we know this system, right? Rated R, rated PG, parental guidance, that kind of thing. Well, prior to that rating system, there was the Hays Code, and it was established under the leadership of a former postmaster general, kind of unexpected there, but anyway, he was a postmaster general named Will Hays, and what he actually started with was not so much a code as it was a list of don'ts and be carefuls. That was what it was called, the list of don'ts and be carefuls. And, you know, those were things that the studios could use to govern themselves in answer to growing concerns that the films were featuring and glamorizing morally objectionable content. Now, you can go out on YouTube and you can look up pre-code Hollywood and you can see some film clips. And it was pretty raunchy, some of the stuff that was going on. I mean, there was nudity, there was just a whole lot of stuff. I mean, we think that's new to our era, not so. Films like Red Dust, where she's actually shown bathing nude in front of Clark Gable, that was one of the things that got a lot of attention in the day. And so there was a general outcry from the public that, wait a minute, things are getting a little bit out of hand. So there was this list of don'ts and be carefuls. And again, that was something that the studios were supposed to be using to sort of govern themselves. However, that list was loosely enforced. Because it wasn't really enforced very well, the code was formally established. And here's what Hays said about the code's unveiling. He said this: "The code sets up high standards of performance for motion picture producers. It states the considerations which good taste and community value make necessary in this universal form of entertainment. No picture should ever lower the moral standards of those who see it. The sympathy of the audience shall never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin." And that was really a major piece right there, that last bit. The sympathy of the audience shall never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. So one of his big objections was that you may have a criminal, like a gangster, for example, and that gangster is portrayed to draw sympathy from the audience. So that gangster is not looked at as an evil character, but as somebody that you feel sorry for. Or it might be a character that does some sort of wrongdoing and yet is rewarded by it. He never faces any consequences. And so the idea at the time was that, you know, this is really setting a bad example for society, having these kinds of films. And, you know, when people talk about the Hays Code now, there's a lot of criticism about it. And there probably is a lot of criticism to go around. I mean, I'm not really one that's big on censorship for sure. But one of the things that I think is helpful, I mean, we got some really fantastic films out of this era. And I think any time that you put restrictions in place and people have to draw on their creativity within those restrictions, that's where you really see a lot of innovations and some really cool things. I talk about this actually in my day job when I talk with instructional designers. It's like, look, don't look at restrictions as something that's inhibiting what we do. Look at those restrictions as something that is going to force us to be more creative. And so in my view, I kind of think this was a good thing. I know I'm probably in the minority opinion there, but I think any time that you can drive creativity and innovation and also improve quality through restrictions of any kind, I think it's really a good thing. So anyway, there you have the Hays Code. So if you go out to YouTube and you watch movies that are pre-code versus post-code, there's a marked difference. Again, as I said, the pre-code films, things like Hell's Angels, Harlow's film Hell's Angels, Red Dust, those films contained near nudity, sexual promiscuity, and perhaps most importantly, morally objectionable behavior without consequences. Now, all of this was really thrown by the wayside by 1968. So they shifted at that point from restricting filmmakers to warning audience goers. And that's our rating system. So the warning is, hey, audience goers, this film is rated R. You know, a big shift there starting in 1968. Okay, so what were the big studios in the 1930s? Well, there are five studios that are considered the big five of the 1930s, and those were 20th Century Fox, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, and RKO. Then you have the little three, and the little three were Columbia, Universal, and United Artists. What about the biggest stars? Well, there were a lot of big stars in the 1930s. These are names that we all know. Okay, so here's some of the biggest. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I do have a pretty comprehensive list of the biggest stars out in the show notes. So here's just a few of them. Jean Harlow, of course, our friend from tonight's show. Clark Gable, huge in the 1930s. Myrna Loy, Mae West, Greta Garbo, Janet Gaynor, Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, Claudette Colbert. Joan Crawford was a huge star at that time. Joan Crawford, by the way, hated Jean Harlow, couldn't stand her. So I had said earlier that Jean Harlow was really beloved by everybody, and I think that was mostly true, but it wasn't true of Joan Crawford. I think she was just probably pretty jealous because Jean Harlow ultimately became a bigger star. You know, Joan Crawford was Mommy Dearest, not necessarily the nicest person in the world. But there were some other big stars, Bing Crosby, Jeanette MacDonald, Barbara Stanwyck, Norma Shearer was a big star during that time, Tyrone Power, Errol Flynn, Betty Davis, Spencer Tracy. Spencer Tracy, by the way, was in Libel Lady, my favorite Harlow film. Jimmy Stewart, also a big star in the 30s. He was in my other favorite Harlow film, Wife versus Secretary, and oh my gosh, he was so young. Katharine Hepburn, Shirley Temple, this was the era of Shirley Temple, Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, Alice Faye, there were a lot of stars. O.W.C. Fields was another one, so lots of big name stars that we know even today came out of the 30s. Now, what were the most famous films of the 1930s? Well, there were some big ones, and I'm just going to mention a few. Gone with the Wind, probably one of the most popular films of the 1930s. That came out in 1939. Also, coming out in 1939, The Wizard of Oz, King Kong, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, The Lady Vanishes. Oh, by the way, not all of these came out in 1939. Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz did. King Kong came out in 1933. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came out in 1937 and so on. The Lady Vanishes, Charlie Chaplin's City Lights, Top Hat with Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, All Quiet on the Western Front, Stagecoach, Stage Door. That's a fun movie if you haven't seen that one. Stage Door. It's been several years since I've seen that, but it's about a bunch of young women who want to make it in show business. They want to make it on the stage. And one of the stars is a very young Lucille Ball. And that is not a comedy role, if I remember correctly. So it's a dramatic role for her. Bringing Up Baby from 1938, The Thin Man, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, You Can't Take It With You, Tarzan the Ape Man, came out in 1932, Wuthering Heights, 42nd Street, Gunga Din, Grand Hotel. I want to see Grand Hotel. That came out in 1932. That's on my watch list. Ninotchka and Topper. So those were some of the biggest films in the 30s. All right, so what were the Academy Award winners of the 1930s? Well, I'll do a quick rundown starting with 1930. All Quiet on the Western Front. 1931, Cimarron. 1932, Grand Hotel. 1933, Cavalcade. 1934, It Happened One Night. 1935, Mutiny on the Bounty. 1936, The Great Ziegfeld. 1936 is when Libeled Lady was out, and that was nominated for Best Picture that year. So, Libeled Lady, which I love that movie, great movie, It was nominated, did not win, in 1936 for Best Picture. 1937, The Life of Emile Zola. 1938, You Can't Take It With You. And 1939, of course, Gone with the Wind. While I was preparing for this episode, I spent a lot of time reading through the archives of the Kansas City Star newspaper. Now, why was I doing that? Well, first of all, I'm in Kansas City, so that makes a lot of sense. But I was actually looking for one particular article. I had read in one of the books that I was reading about Jean Harlow that she had made big news in Kansas City in 1933 when she visited her family here. And there was a picture taken of her with a bunch of neighbor kids, and it was in the Kansas City Star. So I thought, gosh, I would like to find that article. And I did find it. But along the way, I came across something else that I just had to include in the show tonight. It was an article called The Beauty Business in Hollywood. And I just find it completely enlightening and entertaining. It provides an interesting snapshot of, oh, what a hardship it was to be a star in the 1930s. Jean Harlow was referenced a couple of times in this article. And it's kind of sobering to remember that this was from May of 1937, and she died a month later. I'm going to read this article to you. Actually, I'm going to read an excerpt of the full article to you because I just think this is fabulous. I think maybe more than anything else in this show, it really does give you a little glimpse of what it was like to be a star in the 1930s, especially a female star in the 1930s. The Beauty Business in Hollywood, Kansas City Star, May 1937. Jean Harlow found, when she wore a red wig for the film Red-Headed Woman, that she became much softer in personality. She had her hair tinted golden red. She and her studio agreed that she was more beautiful with the darker hair, but the fans wouldn't stand for it. They liked their Jean platinum, and they wrote thousands of letters to say so. So, platinum it is. Hairstyles are started by the stars, but not consciously. Each star is intending to get the best style for herself. She's flattered if girls all over the country copy it, but she doesn't set out to create a novel hairdressing just for the benefit of the girl in New York. She's quite selfishly trying to bring out the best of her own beauty. The hairdressing is usually designed by the head of the beauty department at her studio. Movie stars seldom have facials. The fact that they apply and remove grease paint every day gives their faces all the massage necessary. They do, however, have body massages constantly as a nerve tonic. The bright lights are hard on nerves. The emotional strain of acting is great. Nothing shows up quicker or with more detriment to beauty than nervous strain. So movie players almost universally find it important to have a masseuse at their homes. After each day's work, the masseuse relaxes their tense muscles and soothes their wrought nerves. Stars pay $5 or $10 a day for this treatment. Makeup is important. All the beauty experts of Hollywood agree that it's makeup that finally produces the glamour girl. But they say makeup is the final touch, not the maker of beauty. I can do wonders with makeup, says Jack Pierce, head of Universal's makeup department. I can thin fat faces, I can make hard mouths soft and appealing. But beauty doesn't come from tubes. The girl must give me a foundation to build on. She must have health, good posture, and proper weight. Then I can make her look beautiful. Perk Westmore, head of Warner's beauty department, says the ordinary woman uses too much makeup and uses it badly. Fire hydrants and danger signs are painted red, says Perk. Anything you want to be noticed right now is red. Rouge on a woman's face calls for and gets attention. The trick is to put it where you want attention. A long, narrow face should not be rouged up and down. unless the woman wants to look like a horse. Round-faced women usually put on round dabs of rouge and too much of it. Women should look at the mirror, figure out the effect that they're going after, and then apply their makeup subtly to attain it. Jeanette McDonald learned something about age as it shows in the face when she was made up for the part of the old lady in the film Maytime. She was told to wrinkle up her face and squint her eyes. Then light powder was dusted on her. She opened her eyes, looked into the mirror, and found fine wrinkles all over her face. Many women, says Westmore, make the mistake of using too light powder and then squinting when applying it. They achieve highlights on top of their wrinkles, and the little creases show dark against the light powder. It adds years to a woman's face. The first advice I give a newly signed player, says Jack Don, head of the MGM beauty department, is go buy a full-length mirror for your bedroom. Then look at it. When the full-length mirror is installed, the ambitious actress starts looking, first of all, at her posture. No woman can be beautiful, states Jack Don, until she stands well. I tell my beginners that they must think of their bodies as a series of boxes. Those boxes must rest exactly one on top of the other without any corners sticking out. They must be exactly in line. Stand naturally in front of your full-length mirror. Look at the way your hips stick out, your stomach bulges. Now lift up that drooping chest. Straighten up those shoulders. Stand on the balls of the feet. Get all the bones lined up, one on top of the other. Your appearance has improved immediately. Now, everyone knows that good posture is necessary for beauty, but since her career depends on it, the young actress is going to work at it. She's going to remember every waking moment to hold herself well, that she's going to sit up straight in her chair, whether she's before the camera or not, and that she's going to lift up that head and hold it up. When Jean Harlow starred in Hell's Angels, she was beautiful, says Jack Don, but her hips looked heavy. Today, at exactly the same weight, she has the most beautiful figure in Hollywood. This is entirely due to the improved posture. She had allowed the pelvic bones to settle just a little heavily into the hip bones. By raising them, her figure became perfect. Movie stars have to keep their weight a bit below normal because of the unfortunate tendency of the camera to add pounds. They can't say, I ought to take off a few pounds, I'll go on a diet tomorrow. No, they go on a diet and stay on it, or they don't stay in the movies. The lemon meringue pies and chocolate eclairs are not for them. The actress has to care, and care a lot, about her career to keep up the ever-necessary diet and posture. As soon as she ceases to think of it more important than anything else, her career ends. Take Clara Bow. Clara Bow was one of the greatest stars. Girls everywhere copied her. Then she stopped thinking of her career as the most important thing in the world. A baked potato became more necessary to her happiness than fan mail. Well, now, this was not a tragedy for Clara. She's become a pretty, plump matron, living happily on a ranch with her husband and child. The Brooklyn Bonfire says the only fire she wants to light from now on is her own hearth fire. She's happier now than she was when she was a star. But few stars feel that way about it. They want to stay at the top, and they're willing to go through a lot to do it. Hollywood stars become beauties by the expenditure of effort, time, and money. The experts say that Mrs. Average Woman can achieve the same results if she wants to. But to become a glamour girl, whether in Hollywood or Kansas City, demands an intensiveness of purpose 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It's not a part-time job. The stenographer spends time and money acquiring and maintaining her technique and speed on the typewriter. The trained nurse spends years getting the professional knowledge by which she'll earn a living. The movie star looks at the need for beauty with the same regard the nurse has for her hospital training. It's a professional necessity for her career. That's the reason Hollywood stars are beautiful. It's their job. Well, we have to talk about the movies, don't we? I mean, Jean Harlow was an actress after all, and she was in a lot of movies. She was in 34 full-length films from 1928 to 1937, to be exact. I did not see all 34 of those films. Actually, I don't know that you could. I think that some of those films are lost. But here's what I found, that in reading these books and articles, I found that there were some titles in that list of 34 films that were mentioned over and over again. And so I sort of took that to mean these were the most important films in her career. And so I sort of grouped them all together and started referring to them as the Harlow canon or the Jean Harlow canon of films. Now, I have to mention that one Harlow film that I liked a lot was Wife Versus Secretary. I mentioned that earlier in the show. That's not included in this list. That one I just happened to see because it was on Amazon Prime, but it was not mentioned all that often in the books that I read. So I did not include that in the canon, but I recommend it. It's a good one. I liked it very much. Okay, so what are the films in the canon? Well, here they are. Hell's Angels. And Hell's Angels is important for a couple of reasons. Remember, that's the film that has the color footage of Jean Harlow, the only color footage that exists. That was not her first film, but it was a huge hit in 1930, and that was where she got her big break. That, by the way, is a film that I saw, and I thought I was going to hate it, frankly, because it's a war movie. It's a movie that takes place in World War I, and I just don't like war movies. I just can't get into them. I find them just so boring most of the time. But I went ahead because this is sort of a big one in her career. I decided I am going to buckle down and I'm going to watch this film. And I've got to tell you, it wasn't half bad. The war stuff, I just get bored with that. I don't like that. But the underlying story was really about these two brothers. And these brothers are just very different from each other, but they sort of help each other in various ways get through the war. And I'll warn you, it does not necessarily have a very happy ending, but I like buddy films. And in this case, they were brothers, but it's sort of that buddy film kind of genre. In addition to that, this was a Howard Hughes film. So he was really an aviator, right? I think everybody knows that. So there was a lot of flight footage in this film that I thought looked pretty advanced when you consider that it was released in 1930, but it was actually, they were working on it before 1930. Interesting story here too, because it took way longer than they anticipated to produce this film, and it went way over budget. One of the reasons for that is because when they started making the film, I think they started like in 1927, it was filmed as a silent movie, but then by the time they started progressing in the production process, the talkies, the films with audio, were really all the rage. And so Hughes was like, well, I put my heart and soul and a lot of money into this film. I'm not going to bypass this opportunity. We need to rework it and add the sound. We need dialogue. So they kept some of the footage that was filmed originally for the silent version, but any dialogue they reworked. Now they had to replace the main female lead because she had a really thick accent. So that worked in the silent version. It didn't work in the sound version. And so that's ultimately how Jean Harlow got her big break. That film had really advanced looking cinematography. I was pretty impressed with it. But it came at a cost because there were pilots that lost their lives in this film, making this movie. So you could do a whole show, a whole Circus Sunday night just on Hell's Angels. Lots of interesting things about that particular film. Anyway, that's the first film in the canon. Platinum Blonde. Now, again, Howard Hughes, Platinum Blonde was not one of his films, but Howard Hughes coined that phrase. He actually was the first to refer to Jean Harlow as the Platinum Blonde. Redheaded Woman, Red Dust, Hold Your Man, Dinner at Eight is a fun movie. Dinner at Eight, Bombshell, The Girl from Missouri, Libeled Lady, and Saratoga. Jean Harlow's last film, she died during the filming of that movie. I mean, she didn't die on the set. She collapsed on the set. She was, taken off the set. She was hospitalized. And she died, I don't know, a week later or something after she left the film set. We'll talk a little bit more about Saratoga later on. Okay, that's a movie that I mentioned before. I am not ready to see. Okay, so of these movies, the ones that I saw were Hell's Angels, Platinum Blonde, Red Dust, Dinner at Eight, Bombshell, The Girl from Missouri, Libeled Lady, and yeah, that's it. Those are the films that I saw. And I mean, you can see a steady progression. I put those, by the way, in the order that they were produced. And you can definitely see a progression in her talent. In Hell's Angels, she was pretty amateur. She was beautiful. I mean, she was so young. I think she was 18 years old in that movie. And like I said, she never really became a fantastic actress, but she did get to be a lot better, and her performances were just very endearing. Now, I will say that in the movie that I mentioned before, Wife versus Secretary, I thought there was a really pretty moving scene at the end to that movie. The movie has a little bit of a goofy storyline that doesn't quite translate so well to our modern day, but I enjoyed it anyway. And her performance was really pretty moving. So anyway, those are the films that I would consider to be the Jean Harlow canon. Okay, we have to talk about Libeled Lady in a little bit more detail because, as I mentioned a few times before, that is my favorite Jean Harlow film. I think it's the finest film in the canon. And there were a couple of times when I actually laughed out loud. Interestingly, Jean Harlow was given top billing, but her role was actually a supporting role. She was not the Libeled Lady that's in the title. That was Myrna Loy. Harlow got top billing. Why was that? Well, she was a gigantic star at this point. I mean, she was really at the height of her career. And she also, by the way, died at the height of her career. So this was one of her final films. I think she only made a couple more films after this one. And so her acting was really well developed at this point. And she was adorable in this film. She was just so much fun to watch. She proved in this movie that she was a really fine comedic actress. She was not a dramatic actress. That just wasn't her. Although I think she could have developed into one. I think the feeling was there, the feeling and the vulnerability was there to develop that in her, but we'll never know because she died so young. But she was a really fun comedic actress to watch. That was her forte. I'm going to play a clip for you, and this is one of my favorite clips in the film. It comes pretty early in the film. I'm not going to go over the plot line yet. I'll go over that in a moment, but I just want you to picture this scene. Jean Harlow plays a woman named Gladys Benton. She's been engaged to this man named Warren Haggerty, played by Spencer Tracy, for a really long time. And, you know, Haggerty he loves her, but he just doesn't want to marry her. He's one of these guys that's married to his job. And so he's been putting off and putting off and putting off this wedding. Well, she finally got him to set a date, and the date is today. But he's been trying to find a way to get out of this wedding, and lucky for him, there's a crisis at the newspaper. So he's got the perfect excuse. So instead of going to the church, which is where he's supposed to be, he goes to the newspaper. Well, you can imagine Gladys Benton, his fiance, is furious about this. So the scene that I'm about to play for you is, it's just so much fun. Imagine this. It's Jean Harlow in this role. She's all decked out in her wedding dress and her veil and her bouquet, and she is steaming mad. She charges through the newsroom to confront Warren Haggerty. So let's listen.
I knew I'd find you with a drink in your hand.
What are you doing here?
Well, what are you doing here?
What, didn't Ching tell you?
Yes, Ching told me, and I told him, and now I'm telling you. I won't stand for it. You can't do this to me, Warren Haggerty. Not to me. First it was a fire at sea, then it was the kidnapping. What's the gag this time?
Darling, there's no gag. The newspaper has made a terrible mistake.
Yeah, well, so is little Gladys. Engaged to a newspaper man. Joe Simpson never treated me like this.
Then why did you divorce him?
I've asked myself that plenty of times.
Oh, now, Gladys, after all, you got no kick.
Oh, I haven't. First you said a trip to Bermuda.
You went to Bermuda?
Yeah, but alone. Then it was Europe. Huh. If I wait another year, it'll be little America. Well, I won't. Come on.
I tell you, I can't get away.
Oh, it's not Europe. It's the church. It only takes 20 minutes to get married.
But, Gladys, the trip.
Yeah, I'll take Battery Park.
Oh, no, I'm going to take you on the greatest trip that a girl ever had. Just as soon as we settle the suit.
Nothing doing. For 2 years, I've played second fiddle to this paper.
But the boss is waiting for me, darling.
Mm-hmm. Well, the preacher's waiting to get your hat.
I tell you, I can't go now. The paper's in a jam. We're facing a libel suit.
Well, you're facing a breach of promise suit. If you don't want to marry me, just say so.
I'm glad you're getting yourself all upset, darling, over here. A little drinky, maybe.
No, not today I don't. Today I get married.
Well, I... Look...
Hey, didn't they tell you I wanted to see you? Say, what is this? Do I own a paper or a lunatic asylum?
You just took the words out of my mouth.
Mr. Bain, my future wife.
Nonsense. I'll be in my office. Get rid of this woman.
Hey, take it easy, will you? That's the owner of the paper.
Well, I don't care who he is. Nobody can talk to me like a house detective.
How do you know how a house detective talks?
Don't you think I read? Hey, why are you... Oh, no, you don't. If you think
Gladys,
that you can...
Gladys, darling. Now, you tell the preacher to wait, see, and I'll phone you just the minute I'm free. Mm-hmm. And we'll get married today, Gladys. Now, that's a promise. That's a promise. Tomorrow at this time, you'll be a married woman. I swear to it, darling. Joe, come here.
Yes,
you look beautiful. Will you show Miss Benton to a taxi?
And this is supposed to be the happiest day of a girl's life.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I love that scene. And I just, you can go out on YouTube and you can actually watch this scene. Actually, I recommend you just watch the movie because it's just so much fun. But this is just a great scene. And it really sets the tone for the rest of the film because there's these ups and downs that Gladys has to go through throughout the film. I mean, she's not the central character, but she's the most interesting character for sure in this movie. I wrote up a little summary of the plot in the show notes, and so I'm just going to read that to you. In this romantic comedy, Harlow plays Gladys Benton, the long-suffering fiancée of Warren Haggerty, played by Spencer Tracy. Haggerty is the managing editor of the New York Evening Star newspaper. When the Evening Star prints a story falsely accusing wealthy socialite Connie Allenberry, played by Myrna Loy, of stealing another woman's husband, she vows to sue the paper for $5 million for libel. In an effort to make Allenberry drop the suit, Haggerty enlists the help of former colleague Bill Chandler, played by William Powell, to cook up a totally crazy scheme. And this is a crazy scheme. Here's the plan. Haggerty coaxes Gladys to marry Chandler in name only. While married, Chandler will then woo Connie Allenberry and get her to fall for him. Gladys will discover Chandler and Connie together and reveal to Connie that she and Chandler are married. Haggerty will swoop in, threaten to print a story about this affair unless Connie agrees to drop the libel suit. This scheme almost works, except for a few complications, namely that Gladys starts to think she might actually love her sham husband, and Chandler really does fall for Connie Allenberry. Now, this really is one of those mixed-up, crazy, romantic comedy situations, and when you watch the film, all of this complexity makes a lot of sense, but it's just a lot of fun to watch. I think Libel Lady is a wonderful film for a number of reasons. First of all, the writing is really good. The storyline's goofy, but it completely draws the audience along, and it's genuinely funny. But as I mentioned before, I think Jean Harlow is really the gem in this picture. She steals every scene that she's in. Her character is used and hurt by all three of her co-stars, and Harlow's response to their betrayals, it's just moving and comical at the same time. Now, Jean is not the platinum blonde in this film. Her hair is much more subdued. It's kind of got that brownette type of color, so it's kind of brown blonde. And to me, I think she's at her most beautiful. I'm going to play one more clip of this film. This comes toward the end. And, this is at a point in the film where Gladys, played by Jean Harlow, has really been run through the ringer. I mean, she's been used. She's fallen in love with one person, but she was sort of, you know, snubbed by another. And so poor Gladys at the end of this film. And here's a confrontation that happens. This is not the end of the film. So not a true spoiler here, but it's toward the end of the film.
As Mrs. William Chandler, I demand that I...
There must be some mistake. You see, this is Mrs. Chandler.
What?
What?
Yes, it has been for a whole hour.
Yes, we were just married.
Have you gone crazy?
If you think you can excuse this by pulling a marriage tag, you've just got...
We are married, really.
Oh, yes. I always carry our marriage certificate right with me.
Mrs. Elmer, wouldn't you? They're married, all right.
Oh, but that's arson.
You mean it's bigamy? What a story. Connie Allenbury marries bigamist.
Oh, if you print that in your paper, you'll have another libel suit on your hands. I'm not a bigamist.
You married me, didn't you?
Well, that one doesn't count.
What are you talking about?
About a certain Mr. Joseph Simpson, your lawfully wedded husband.
What are you trying to hand me? I've been divorced from Simpson for...
Oh, well, you see, you got your divorce in Yucatan by mail. Well, 3 years ago, all Yucatan divorces were declared illegal. I found that out yesterday in the Hall of Records. Also consulted my attorney.
Then you and Gladys were never really married?
That's right.
Oh, but it's all right. I made an honest man of him. Oh, dear, don't forget the letter.
Oh, yes. This is from Mrs. Chandler for you, Warren. You know, she was so touched by your... pity for your 500 starving employees. You dropped the suit.
Oh,
but I...
Miss Allen, Mrs. Chandler, how can I ever... I just can't believe it. Well, Connie Allenbury marries Arthur. What a story. What a scoop.
Oh, Mr. Haggerty, you've forgotten something.
Oh, yes, my hat, excuse me.
Your hat and Mrs. Simpson.
Mrs. Simpson? Oh, Gladdy, of course. That Mrs. Simpson gets me, Gladdy. Now I've got to run along to the office, hon. You phone me there in the morning, huh? You sweet little...
Just a minute. You want a real scoop? Well, I'll give you one. I found out my Yucatan divorce was no good, so I got a second divorce from Joe Simpson in Reno.
What?
Well, then we're not...
I don't believe it.
Then try the Reno Hall of Records.
But if that's
quite right. Now where do we all stand?
Another good scene there. Okay, well, so Libel Lady is a must-see for anyone who likes classic romantic comedies. It was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture in 1936, and as I mentioned, it did not win, but I think it should have. Well, you will never guess what I have in my hot little hands right now. I have a novel, and it's a novel I have been waiting for. I ordered this several days ago, and I have been waiting breathlessly for this novel to arrive. Guess who the author is? That's right, Jean Harlow. Jean Harlow was a writer. She wrote one novel, Today is Tonight is the name of it, and it was not published in her lifetime. It was actually published in the 1960s. But I'll tell you, these books, Today is Tonight, that is a title that is hard to come by. And I've actually wanted to read this for years, but it's really hard to find these. They're out of print, and when you do find them, they are not cheap. So I have seen some hardcovers of this book in the $350 to $400 range. Okay, that's not what this is. This is a paperback book, but it was not cheap either. So I'm looking at the front cover right now, and it sold for 60 cents. So back in the 60s, when you would pick this up in your local drugstore, it was 60 cents. It cost me almost $60 for this little tiny paperback book. Yes, it did, but I'm happy to have it. It's in excellent condition. It's yellowed, of course, because this is many years old, but it's really in excellent condition. No creases, no tears, no nothing. It looks fabulous. Okay, so Jean Harlow was a voracious reader. She was also a writer, but she was a reader too. And in fact, when she died, she was reading Gone with the Wind. And there's kind of a sad story that I read in this Sten book. where at one point she was being transported from I don't know, from her home to the hospital or whatever, I can't remember. And she said, oh, I want to make sure and take Gone with the Wind. You know, make sure you pack my Gone with the Wind book, because apparently she hadn't finished it yet. And the nurses kind of looked at each other because they knew she would never finish it. They knew already that she was dying. Oh my gosh, what a sad story. But anyway, she loved to read, but she also liked to write. And apparently she even wrote as a child. So this was sort of a lifelong hobby for her. And she used her own life as a model for her characters and her plot lines. So let's talk about Today is Tonight. Her stepfather tried to shop it around to a few studios. However, Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, prevented its sale. And he cited a clause in her contract that stated that her services as an artist couldn't be used without MGM's permission. So he really put the kibosh on that. After her death, her mother sold the film rights to MGM, but no film was made, and then the novel just kind of was forgotten, I guess. It remained unpublished. It wasn't actually published until the 1960s. All right, so let's talk about what is this book about? Well, I wish I could tell you more about it because I wanted to read it before I taped this show. So here's my plan. I am going to read this and talk about it in an upcoming episode of Circa Sunday Night, probably the next episode. So the next episode will drop in 2 weeks, and I will be sure that I talk about this book because I will have read it by then. Okay, so here is what it says on the front cover. Jean Harlow's explosive, long-suppressed novel. Wow. Okay, and then on the back, it has a little summary here. It says, "Today is tonight. It was the roaring 20s when everyone acted as if sex were his own invention and prohibition just a scheme to raise the price of whiskey. It was a time of rich and beautiful people, of opulent living and wild weekend parties, of easy love and unrestrained passion. But for Peter and Judy Lansdowne, the most beautiful of them all, it became a time to test even more their own obsessive love." Okay, now the publisher goes on to write this. "All the flamboyance, intimacy, and implicit tragedy of the era over which Jean Harlow reigned, and which, much later, she came to symbolize, are brought to vivid life in this remarkable novel, a shattering love story and an unforgettable glimpse into the soul of its scandal-plagued author." Ooh. Well, I just couldn't be more excited to finally have this book in my hands. I'm going to start reading it tonight. Okay, but she did not just write that novel. She wrote other things as well. In my research, I was able to find a short story that she wrote called Extra Girl Gets Her First Close-Up. Now, she wrote this in 1935, and it was published in the Hollywood Reporter that year. Okay, so the writing is not fabulous, but I think it's charming. And so I'm going to read it for you tonight. It's very short. Here we go with a short story by Jean Harlow. Extra Girl Gets Her First Close-Up by Jean Harlow. Suppose, oh, just suppose, it doesn't cost anything. Suppose she should get a close-up today. The thought warmed her. She had summoned it into mental existence many hundreds of times, just for the sake of that warming tingle which came in its wake. After all, it wasn't impossible. It does happen to extra girls. Well, not regularly, but frequently enough to justify the perennial visualization of its glorious possibility. She thought about herself very carefully. She surveyed her whole person in critical analysis as if she were someone else, just as she had actually and meticulously studied herself that morning in the bleary mirror of her bathroom door. A smooth white body, unflawed, taut with youth, curved with promise, clean with hope. She found nothing much to criticize, except she did not have artificial eyelashes. She tried to compensate herself with the assurance that at least her eyebrows conformed to the Hollywood convention. Of course, it had been something of an effort to shave the brows cleanly off this morning and to pencil in the thin, highly arched arcs of unreality in place of the silky ash blonde hairs. She had postponed this for almost a year. It did not, however, give the complete effect. She must have the artificial lashes. Now, her own lashes, upper and lower, were adequate, even abundant, but they were real, and hence marked her as one of the rank and file. She had stopped wearing stockings 6 months ago. Well, stockings cost too much, but more importantly, was the reason that bare legs may not be classified so readily as stockinged ones, and she was conscious that the curves of her calves were vaguely irregular. Her mouth was her strong point. Mouth, which means, on only visual contact, lips. She had made her lips important by long hours of study in the mirror. The carmine lipstick now outlined the upper lip in a sweeping single curve, so brutally false as to provoke a second and interested glance. It was a cheap lipstick. She'd found it in a Boulevard drugstore, but it made provoking the wet smear of lambent color. For 7 weeks, she had planned to buy the artificial eyelashes. Well, it was not a tragic necessity for food or shelter which weekly devoured the eyelash appropriation. No, it was the 1,001 other little things, even more important to an extra girl. Shoes. Assistant directors always looked at your feet first. Hair. No matter how simple a coiffure you evolve, the beauty shop cannot be dodged forever. Makeup. You'll never get a close-up unless your makeup is satin smooth with the very best grease and powder and shadings. Telephone calls. Not only the daily routine to central casting, but the 3 or 4 calls every day to Marcella or Red or Tommy, the several various persons in different studios who had manifested a degree of friendliness sufficient to warrant a call reminding them of your existence. Hats. You can't fake hats the way you can fake clothes. Hats change, irrevocably. Transportation. The cruelest burden of all the burdens. First National, way over in the valley. Metro, far out in Culver City. Fox, in Westwood. Funny the way Easterners come out here and expected to find all the studios cuddled up in one handy group in the heart of Hollywood. Hollywood? Well, Hollywood isn't a city. Hollywood isn't even a district. Hollywood is the name of an idea, and its ramifications stretch expensively far and wide for the extra girl. Her nose wrinkled delicately with the shadow of an impish grin. Maybe she'd wave her spirit of independence long enough to accept that 125 from Daddy and buy a second-hand Ford. Maybe she wouldn't, either. Even without the artificial eyelashes, she knew she looked hot today. There were only, she counted, 20 girls on the set. She knew very well that at least 12 of them had been selected from the assistant director's list. The other 8 had come direct from central casting. That's funny, too. And she remembered what that nice woman at central casting had told her, how the real problem was not only finding work for extras, but finding the right extras for the work. How few really lovely, well-dressed girls, had she said, were available? She relaxed with satisfaction. Yes, she was undoubtedly the best-looking, best-dressed, best-made-up extra on the set. And that without counting her hair. Her hair would get her a break someday, she felt sure. Its pale ashen loveliness was natural. She liked to announce that fact somewhat arrogantly to the bleached sisters. As a matter of fact, it was not her hair which attracted the assistant director. His roving eye flickered about and settled on her, because she was the one girl in the lot that he had not quite classified. He had actually nothing on her. He'd heard rumors, but rumors are nothing in Hollywood. His wife, who had secretly worked extra under an assumed name, had sniffed quite vigorously one night at that blonde dame with her $22 Fifth Avenue shoes. Still, he could comfort himself on his selection of her with the reassurance that she was really the most striking girl of all the 20. "You," he said curtly, "be ready for a close-up at 3 o'clock. She looked at him dully, not quite segregating his actuality from the endlessly dreamed visions of this moment. Then she knew it was reality, because his eyes lingered on her for a second. His gaze was not less vicious or acquisitive. It was kindly and gracious. In a sudden warm flash of understanding, she realized that assistant directors are human. They probably dine on meat and vegetables rather than fire and brimstone, and even possibly might have been born through the ordinary human processes of life. The director was rehearsing a dialogue two-shot. From experience, she knew the leading man would not acquire the proper emphasis for at least another hour. She walked proudly off the set with the sure knowledge that she was entitled to some time for preparation. She was going to have a close-up. The kindly hairdresser responded nobly. The ash-blonde hair was done and redone and done again. The makeup was removed and put on anew with loving care and trembling hands. If only she had those artificial eyelashes! Why hadn't she yielded to the temptation this morning? Why hadn't she turned her steps into that drugstore? Now, there is a god, even in Hollywood. It was certainly one of his minions, this slim southern girl in stock, who overheard the lament and proffered a pair of artificial eyelashes for the great event. "Hop to it, kid," were her words. "Here, good luck." They were ready and waiting when she came back to the set. It was more important than an outsider would think. They would make several takes of that close-up, and the producer himself, to say nothing of his staff and secretaries and the director and maybe even the head man who sat in his mahogany hell of an office, would be interested in the day's rushes and thus forced to look full into this lovely face of hers for several minutes. With an approving nod, the assistant director took her firmly by the arm and led her to a spot about which dazzling lights were concentrated. Her heart was bursting within her. "Sit there on the arm of the couch." The director himself was speaking. "Pull up your skirts, way up, above your knees." Then she understood. They were going to take a close-up of her legs. Now we have to talk about the death of Jean Harlow, and I don't like this part because, as I mentioned before, I'm kind of, you know, I'm so immersed in the Jean Harlow stuff that I don't like the ending of this story. She died very young at 26. It was not a good way to die, especially back then. She died of kidney failure. She was misdiagnosed, but it was kidney failure. You know, that bombshell book, the Sten book that I've referenced earlier in the show, really goes into great detail about her death, and it was not a great way to die. I'm not going to go into that much detail, but by the way, if you're interested in reading those books and all the other stuff, I've got it all out in the show notes, so feel free to go out there and check that out. The thing about Jean Harlow's death is it was so unexpected. Remember when Princess Diana died? I mean, it was shocking, right? I mean, she was in the prime of her life, and all of a sudden, she's gone. Well, that's really how it was with Jean Harlow. But it is interesting that when I was in the Kansas City Star archives, I was specifically looking around June, the early part of June of 1937, because that's when she died. And I wanted to see what the paper was showing. You know, how were they following this? And it's interesting because in the days leading up to her death, there were quite a few headlines that were sort of up and down. So there was a headline about her illness. There was another headline that was like, oh, she's on the mend. You know, she's taken a turn. It looks like things are getting better. And then on the day before she died, the headline was, she's recovered, or she's nearly recovered. And her mother was quoted as saying, okay, well, we're out of the woods. The worst part is over. Now it's just a matter of time, you know, getting her back to work and all of that kind of thing. And then the very next day she died. So you can imagine how shocking this would have been to all of her fans. And I remember reading somewhere in one of the articles that I read that the commissary there at MGM was dead silent the whole day. You know, everybody was very distressed by her death. And plus, she was so popular. People really loved her. I mean, the people that knew her. So this was really hard to take. The love of her life, William Powell, he was there apparently at her bedside, and it hit him extremely hard. He was sobbing and just visibly shaken by the whole thing. So there was a lot of drama there at the end. It was not a good way to die. So let's kind of get to the narrative from Wikipedia. On May 20th, 1937, during the filming of Saratoga, Harlow began to complain of illness. Her symptoms, fatigue, nausea, fluid retention, and abdominal pain, did not seem very serious to her doctor, who believed she was suffering from influenza. Unfortunately, the doctor was not aware that Harlow had been ill during the previous year with a severe sunburn and influenza. Her friend and co-star, Una Merkel, noticed Harlow's gray pallor, fatigue, and weight gain on the set of Saratoga. On May 29, 1937, Harlow filmed a scene in which the character she was playing had a fever. Harlow was clearly sicker than her character. She leaned against co-star Clark Gable between scenes and said, "I feel terrible. Get me back to my dressing room." Harlow requested that the assistant director telephone William Powell, who immediately left his own movie set in order to escort Harlow back home. The next day, Powell checked on Harlow and discovered that her condition had not improved. He contacted her mother and insisted that she cut her holiday short to be at her daughter's side. Powell also summoned a doctor. Because Harlow's previous illnesses had delayed the shooting of three movies, Wife vs. Secretary, Susie, and Libel Lady, initially there was no great concern regarding Harlow's latest bout with the recurring illness. On June 2, 1937, it was announced that Harlow was again suffering from influenza. Dr. Ernest Fishbaugh, who had been called to Harlow's home to treat her, diagnosed her with an inflamed gallbladder. Harlow felt better on June 3, 1920 or 1937, and co-workers expected her back on the set by Monday, June 7. Press reports were contradictory, with headlines reading, "Jean Harlow seriously ill," and "Harlow recovers from illness crisis." And again, stepping out of Wikipedia here for a minute, that's exactly what I saw in the archives of the Kansas City Star. Okay, back to Wikipedia. Clark Gable, who had visited Harlow during this time, later remarked that she was severely bloated and that he smelled urine on her breath when he kissed her, both signs of kidney failure. Oh gosh, okay, so apparently there is more detail here in Wikipedia than I had anticipated. Dr. Leland Chapman, a colleague of Fishbaugh, was called in to give a second opinion on Harlow's condition. Chapman recognized that she was not suffering from an inflamed gallbladder, but was in the final stages of kidney failure. On June 6, 1937, Harlow said that she could not see Powell clearly, and she could not tell how many fingers he was holding up. So let me stop right there. In the Bombshell book, at one point late in her illness, when she was really getting bloated, this Dr. Chapman, the minute he walked in the door, apparently he got teary-eyed because he could see it was too late, that there was really not much that he could do for her. So, oh my gosh, how heart-wrenching that was. And then at one point around this time, and I don't see this in the Wikipedia article, but at one point, her mother, who was beside herself, was saying, you know, fight on, fight on. Or maybe I'm confusing this with William Powell. One of them, either Powell or the mother, said, you know, hang in there so you can get better. You know, try to get better, try to get better. And she said, I don't want to get better. Somewhere along the line in that Bombshell book, the author said that she was just not really a fighter. She was never a fighter. And she felt so bad at this point. I mean, physically, she was just in terrible shape. that she was essentially giving up at that point. Okay, back to Wikipedia. We're on June 6th here. That evening, she was taken to Good Samaritan Hospital in Los Angeles, where she slipped into a coma. The next day at 11:37 a.m., Harlow died in the hospital at the age of 26. In the doctor's press releases, the cause of death was given as cerebral edema, a complication of kidney failure. Okay, so let's talk about Saratoga then at this point, because remember, she was in the middle of filming that movie. Well, MGM planned to reshoot the film and just replace Harlow, but the public outcry was no, they wanted a chance to say goodbye to their star. And so they wanted the film released with Harlow in it. Well, there were some scenes that had not been completed yet. And so here was the solution, according to Wikipedia. MGM planned to replace Harlow in Saratoga with either Jean Arthur or Virginia Bruce, but due to public objections, the film was finished using three doubles, one for close-ups, one for long shots, and one for dubbing Harlow's lines. They also rewrote some scenes without Harlow's character. Saratoga was released on July 23, 1937, less than 2 months after Harlow's death, and it was a hit with audiences. Saratoga became MGM's second highest-grossing picture of 1937, and I think it was the highest-grossing film of all of Jean Harlow's films. So as we wrap up this episode, I just have this to say, I am not somebody that watches a lot of movies. And so this is sort of a new thing for me to profile movie stars. But I have to say, this one was really interesting to me. So much happened in Jean Harlow's short life. She started out in Kansas City. She was born into a well-to-do family, by the way. So this was not a rags-to-riches kind of story. But there was a lot of tumult in her family. She didn't really know her father. A lot of the men that she married were very unlikely mates for her, and they tended to be sort of like father figures. Go figure out how that happened. You know, she didn't really have much of a relationship with her own father. Her mother was overbearing. And so she found herself a movie star. I mean, it's really kind of a fascinating story, and it explains why there have been films made about her. So anyway, I'm going to close the book on Jean Harlow for now. Perhaps we will revisit her or revisit Saratoga if I ever do watch it. I will revisit that in a future episode of Circa Sunday Night. But I have to say, I really enjoyed all of the research involved in this episode. My goodness, we have to turn this show around. We just ended on a very somber note, right? We were talking about death and dying and disease and all of this really sad stuff. And that's not what Circa Sunday Night is about. This is about fun and uplifting stuff that gets our mind off of our troubles. So we're going to really turn things around at this point by focusing on my favorite thing of the week. And my favorite thing this week is a sandwich. I know, pretty wacky, right? And it even gets more wacky when you get to know this little bit of information about me. I am not a foodie, and I don't really get into recipes, and I don't believe I've ever shared a recipe on the Circa 19XX website or anywhere. Maybe I have, but if so, it's a very rare occurrence. And also, I am not a healthy eater, and what I'm about to share with you sounds pretty healthy to me. This may be the only healthy thing I eat. Okay, so I'm not really very proud of my eating habits. I need to change them, but I just don't. So anyway, but this is a really healthy snack and a healthy lunch, and I've been eating these every day. Okay, so here it is. Alfalfa sprouts on toast. Very easy to assemble. The alfalfa sprouts are the star of the show here. So you start by taking two extra thin slices of whole grain bread. On one of those slices, you spread a thick layer of hummus. Then you layer on a lot of sprouts. I say the more the better. So I usually take like a fistful of alfalfa sprouts and I just plop them right on top of that hummus. I top it with provolone cheese and then put the other slice of bread on top of that. And there you have it, an alfalfa sprouts on toast sandwich. It is oh so good, and it is my favorite thing of the week. Okay, so we have had so much to explore and talk about in tonight's episode, and now it's time to rest. We've got a 5-day work week coming up. I know, not so exciting, right? But no worries, because Friday will be here before we know it. Have a great week, and I will see you soon.